Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. Is this not working?
I don't know. Let's see.
I think it is.
Is it all right?
Come closer to us.
Okay. So welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. Our meeting is one of 20-some that are throughout the world. And we all have one thing in mind, and that is the spread broadcasting of the idea of universal brotherhood. And we will be reading shortly the declaration, but it's a declaration that all the United Lodges read at their meetings. So it's a binding, even though we are independent and we run our meetings how the group sees fit, it is a binding idea that keeps us all together as one focal point that puts forth these ancient ideas that we were lucky enough to have put down in writing in the mid-1800s. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So in order for this lodge to fulfill the ideas that we just saw in the declaration, we do have two meetings a week. As today we're here, the meeting starts at 11 and runs until 12. The doors open at 10:30. The book table is open before and after the meeting. And on Sundays, for the month, we usually have an overall topic, an umbrella topic, and then the meetings each have an idea of that umbrella topic that we discuss. And it's normally a panel, we can have a lecture, or there's a meeting that we have that is we call a forum, which is a shorter lecture. So today we're looking at the overall topic is theosophy and the theosophical movement. And today we're looking at the ideas of the work and knowledge of great souls. And next week we'll be looking at the theosophical objectives. On Wednesdays, we have started back in The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, which is a synthesis of HPB's great work, The Secret Doctrine. And the classes run from 7:30 until 8:30. The library opens at 5:15 and is open until 7:15. It's a reference library, so you can come in, browse around, look at the books, read them. We also have the piece from the book that we're going to be reading, that we're going to be discussing that night. And there's always a reference that goes along with it, and so that will be available so that one can prepare for the class. So we'll be we think we're starting on chapter 2 of that?
No.
The second half of chapter 1. Okay. The United Lodge of Theosophists is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. We're not sure if we said that the book table is open before and after the Wednesday night meetings as well. So today, as was said, we're looking at Theosophy and the Theosophical Movement for this month, and we'll be looking at the idea. We'll have a panel on the ideas of work and knowledge of great souls. So we'll have first a short talk on work of these great souls, what they do and why they do it, and then we'll have what that knowledge is that they will be, that they focus on and that they pass on to us. So first of all, we have to look at the idea of what is a great soul. And because if we believe in the idea of karma and reincarnation, there has to be a purpose for this. And that purpose is the progression, the perfection of the soul. Reincarnation is that process that occurs when each soul progresses along, learning its lessons, doing its duty in each lifetime. And as that soul progresses, there are different levels of perfection that occur. So when we're talking about great souls, then, I mean, who are they? Are we great souls? We certainly have that. It is inherent in us to become a great soul. We always say here that we are gods in the making. Well, we have all the knowledge that's in here, but we have to get out of our way in order to understand what those high spiritual ideas are. So there are different names that we hear when we're speaking of these great souls. We are considered companions. We help to put out, we learn these ideas, we put these ideas out, we help others, we want to spread broadcasts to as many folks as we can. But at the same time, we do not proselytize. We feel as though if somebody is coming here, they are meant to come here, and that they have probably been exposed to these ideas at some point in a past life. So then, as one goes up the level of perfection, we're looking at the idea of lay chelas and chelas. And then there's lay chelas are a person of the world, so to speak, who kind of puts forth his idea that indeed he really does want to become involved and focus his life on it. But there may be something still that is preventing him from totally giving over his whole life and his spirituality to that. And then, of course, there is the chela, and he is one who is dedicated to a spiritual teacher. Now, this teacher, he may or may not actually know, but that teacher has identified him. And his thing is to learn the hidden mysteries in nature and what those psychic powers are that are latent in man. And then, of course, there are the masters and the adepts, the Mahatmas. And these are people that have been as we are and have progressed towards perfection over the course of who knows how many eons. And they have been able to get their lower nature completely under control. That doesn't mean that their lower nature is gone. It just means that they are able to control it. So that is who that is what a great soul is. And man, as the most intelligent being in the universe, so then as we can see, has never been without a friend. These friends being these great souls. So the work of these great souls then is to support and to kind of uplift their younger brothers, their companions, the manifestations of the human. And the progress that that we make, we need help. And each person has their own rate of progression. We can't really compare ourselves to anyone else because we don't know where we have come from in a past life, and we don't know what the person next to us has been through. So these elder brothers then help us, as well as they preserve this knowledge that has come down through eons before it was put down in writing, which we are so lucky to have now. They help to develop the intelligence of the race, and they are very concerned with the destiny of the not only the world but of the soul. And they keep this knowledge that they have gained, they keep it among themselves for the benefit of mankind. And at periodically, cyclically, as the world keeps moving in cycles, they will put forth a portion of these ideas. And it was Madame Blavatsky in the mid-1800s that put forth these ideas from her teachers. And at that point, we have the printing press, so we were able to put these ideas down in book or pamphlet form so that they could be spread more. And these great souls sometimes are known, sometimes they're not. They work behind the scenes, and sometimes they are known to people. We've talked about Buddha and Mahatma Gandhi and Count Saint Germain. All these people and more have been known to be these great souls, and they have protected these ideas and from being washed out, to being destroyed, so that they wouldn't be put forth anymore. And we know about Origen, who, it's interesting with Origen that he was, we only know about him because the church wrote about his ideas and how they were against the ideas of Christianity, so that we know about what his ideas were because of what they wrote down, that they didn't want people to believe these ideas. So they have been worshipped as gods. Some have been hunted as devils. They've been rulers. They've been teachers, philosophers. And some of them are still unknown. We know that their actions have taken place, but we don't know who they are. And we want to talk about one thing that HPB writes about, and that's the idea of the guardian wall, which is one of the most important when we look at the work of these great souls. Because the guardian wall, as HPB explains, says, it is taught that the accumulated efforts of long generations of yogis, saints, and adepts, especially of the Nirmanakayas, have created, so to say, a wall of protection around mankind, which wall shields mankind invisibly from still worse evils. So it's not like an actual physical wall, but it is these great souls that keep an eye and support the younger brothers. And in the Voice of the Silence, there's also a quote regarding the guardian wall. Self-doomed to live through future kalpas, unthanked and unperceived by man, wedged as a stone with countless other stones which form the guardian wall, such is thy future if the seventh gate thou passest, built by the hands of many masters of compassion, raised by their tortures, by their blood cemented. It shields mankind, since man is man, protecting it from further and far greater misery and sorrow. So we'll look at what the knowledge is of these great souls.
Friends, in thinking about the knowledge of great souls, it should be apparent to us that there is an intimate relation between their work and their knowledge, because the work is just the practical application of what they know. Just as for any one of us, we go through a period of studying and learning in various disciplines, and we reach a point where our knowledge is reached a certain level that it can be applied safely and usefully for the help of others. So some of the ideas that have already been brought out that are important to keep in mind when it comes to the knowledge of great souls is that according to theosophy, all human beings are in their spiritual nature souls in evolution. Souls evolving mentally, morally, spiritually, in their knowledge, capacity, and power in various ways. So the elder brothers then, as these great souls are sometimes called, the elder brothers of humanity are those few great souls produced in any period of evolution who have developed in a relatively few incarnations through their intense effort and training. The higher spiritual perceptions and knowledge that humanity in general will acquire over a seemingly countless series of incarnations. And so each great wave of the evolutionary cycle produces a few of these flowerings, these perfected human beings. And of course, that term perfection is a relative one, because every great period of evolution has its relative degree of perfection, and then a new possibility becomes apparent in the next great wave. So they are the same in kind in their spiritual nature as every one of us, but they differ in the degree from us of their perfected physical, psychic, mental, and moral natures. And that is the key to understanding their knowledge, because knowledge, of course, depends on to what extent you can sense, perceive, and understand what is before you. So they have developed and possess the active use of faculties and powers which lie dormant and latent in us. So we all, to extent, understand willpower or concentration or imagination or creativity. These are all powers within the human soul, within the inner human mind and heart. So we can imagine that they're there potentially, maybe in germ, but they can be developed to a much greater extent. So they, as the possessors of these highly developed faculties, directly know what is still unknowable to our senses. They directly understand and perceive which is unknowable to our minds at this time, and they can understand that which is conceivable to, which is still inconceivable to our state of consciousness. So we speak of things that we are conscious of and unconscious of, even in our own nature. And yet as we go through life, we become more aware of ourselves and we learn things about ourselves that we didn't know previously. So in the same way, as our consciousness expands or deepens, we become aware of things before us in nature and ourselves that were hidden to us from view. So the developed inner spiritual vision of the great soul is what we might call spiritual intuition. Intuition is, in a general definition, direct perception and knowledge of the reality of something without having to go through the process of intellectually trying to figure it out logically and investigate it. It's a knowing. And so this, with this highly developed spiritual faculty then of intuition, they can directly look and know the hidden causes behind the visible and phenomenal effects that we observe on the physical, psychic, and mental plane. So just to put that in perspective for us, as we look at this table, it has a certain appearance to our physical senses, but it doesn't take much knowledge of chemistry and physics to understand that there is a whole world or realm of electrical and magnetic forces and activity going on that are the reality that produce this appearance, but we don't necessarily see it with our physical senses. In the same way, we are aware that certain animals can perceive sounds or see things that are beyond our physical capability of hearing and sight. So these hidden causes are the real causes behind the effects that we observe and call the laws of nature, whether we're speaking of physical, psychic, mental, or moral laws of nature. So they have a thorough understanding of this body of knowledge or these laws of the psychic and spiritual planes, which are currently veiled, hidden, or occult, whatever term you want to use, to our limited plane of perception. So where we might look at this table or a physical object or even a human being or a situation and see just the outer appearance, with their developed spiritual intuition and abilities through their training and long effort, they are able to look into the very heart of things, the very soul of things, the kernel, the psychic and spiritual kernel that is bringing that forth. So we may go into a room and we see two individuals apparently doing the same thing physically, but their inner motive, why they are doing it, the knowledge they bring to it, the feeling, the discrimination, the experience behind their lives that went to that moment where they did that thing, that's not apparent from the physical activity or action itself, and yet it is real but hidden from our view. So in the same way, these great souls are able to look into the soul of nature, the soul of things, we might even into the soul of humanity, and understand the realities behind the physical expression. And like the scientists, they are investigating all things. They observe, they record, and they preserve the record of their findings. And they make minute observations. They check, test, and verify. They experiment, but their field of experimentation, of scientific inquiry, is not just limited to the physical realms observable to our physical senses, and their consciousness is not just limited to what we would call our everyday waking consciousness. They can function consciously on other planes of existence, and we sort of get an idea of that because we know we can consciously function on other planes and states, because we know that we go through a period of conscious existence which is different from the physical waking state. We call it the dreaming state, and there we have faculties, experiences, a sense of time and reality and space which is completely different from what we experience now. And we know that we can take that experience in that dream state, as many writers and artists and musicians and inventors have done, and make it a reality on this plane. So in that sense, these great souls can do that. And they check, test, and verify the recorded observations of long generations of their predecessors, and preserve that record not only in their own nature, but also in actual physical records. So we have a certain kind of soul memory, and we might say it's sort of like riding a bike. Once you learn how to ride a bike, it's sort of preserved in your nature, and maybe you haven't done it for 40 years, but you go somewhere and there's bikes available and you hop on it and you know how to ride a bike. And there are certain things that we acquire through the years that become part of our inner nature, our soul memory. And so we might say that their observations, their learning is recorded in their nature, but also in physical records. And so this spiritual knowledge accumulated over many ages and countless generations is preserved by them. And there are, in fact, times when a portion of this accumulated wisdom of the ages is given out in different cycles in different nations according to the temperament and needs of that particular nation or race or humanity of the time. And the most modern or complete expression of this ancient wisdom, or at least a portion of it, was given out in the latter part of the 19th century by their representatives. And the recorded teaching we have given out is given the name of theosophy, meaning divine wisdom. But of course, in other times, in any other nations or races, it may have been given other names. But generally, it is regarded as an expression of this ancient wisdom religion. And this spiritual knowledge, which was the basis of this ancient wisdom, this was universally diffused, known throughout nations and races in ancient times as well as what we would call prehistoric humanity, because the history of humanity on this planet goes further back in time than our current available records that we have in general would make us believe. So the proofs of its history, that is the history of humanity throughout many prehistoric times and ages, the proofs of the general diffuseness of this ancient wisdom, the records of its history in different lands, the teaching of its great adepts, the character of the teachings and the influence it had in all those nations, and races, the actual documents are actually preserved by this fraternity of great souls away from the ravages of time and humanity, human beings and the weather and so forth, preserved in, you might say, secret crypts, libraries belonging to the fraternity of great depths. So they have this knowledge of the past available to them. So the important thing for us to realize about a Mahatma or a great soul or an adept is it's not the physical body or the personality that we may imagine or see or think about before us. It is rather the inner entity, the soul within, which is great and has reached that exalted and perfected state in former lives as well as reattained it in this one. So the adept, the master, the great soul is the unseen, permanent individuality, not the visible, present personality which is necessary and used by that being during incarnation. So the great soul sort of can keep the two separate. There are times when it has to function from its full Mahatmic capacity and tendency, and there are times when it can just, or that individual can just function on the basis of personality and interact with other human beings. So it is not, it is neither convenient or necessary that the great soul keep that inner spiritual self with all its powers constantly in a full and complete state of function, activity, and awareness, and exercise the complete set of their faculties all the time. Just it is not necessary for us all the time to function the same way, but we can at will call that power into activity. So that an athlete trains to be able to perform at peak when they need to, but they're not constantly in that state of extreme athletic performance. There are times when they can put that at rest, at will, and do other things. So all these powers then have been perfected to the highest degree possible in this particular period of evolution. That's key. So their knowledge is relative to their degree of perfection in this particular period of evolution, but from our point of view, with our limited perception, it might as well be omniscient. And so we revere their knowledge, but we do not worship them. They themselves have said that what is to be regarded as divine and worshipped is the spirit, the universal divine spirit, which is within each and all. They only understand it and know it and have drawn closer to it than we have. So they make no claim to complete infallibility, nor do they claim to be the ultimate spiritual authority in these matters. Nevertheless, they are the faithful and devoted bearers of the light of spiritual truth throughout the ages, and the benefactors, as we've heard, of humanity, where and when cyclic law permits and human nature permits. So then these are just a few of ideas on the work and the knowledge of great souls. And we were thinking in preparing for this presentation, it's sort of like asking a first grader to talk about the knowledge of the professor of a university. I mean, how do you even have the experience and wisdom to, with any degree of certainty, talk about what your teacher or professor knows? It's in some ways, it's kind of an arrogance to even assume you can, but at least we can do is take what they have said, what we have been taught, what we have heard, and try to understand our knowledge from what they have said and what their representatives said about their wisdom and work in the world.
So we'll take any questions. Yes.
I'm sitting here listening, and I'm wondering, my life is filled up with activity and busy, and it's like a workaday life. And I'm sitting here thinking, this is another reality that only lives if I think about it and concentrate on it, or have some value in what it is. Or otherwise, why do I wish to know any of this? I think it comes down to the idea of universal brotherhood, that it does not apply to me, but to us. Therefore, it is impersonal, whereas my life here is so personal that it's like the opposite.
So basically the question then is, practically, how can we use these ideas in our busy world today? And this is where we are in our evolution. We are here because of lessons that we have to learn. We are here now because of what we have done in the past, in past lives. And the philosophy also puts out the idea that this is the Kali Yuga. It's the Dark Age. It is a very intense, dense, materialistic period of our evolution. So we are actually being given opportunities for a faster pace when it comes to our perfection. And right now, it's like we are as busy as we are. We are here. We know that these ideas specifically target universal brotherhood as a fact in nature. So we are actually being given a gift in order to realize that what we have to do in our busy materialistic world is, if we can surmount that as being the focus of our lives, do that kind of work, because it's work that has to be done. It's our duty. But also know that we are here to help others. Then we, you know, it is a, it's a process that we're going through now.
We will just take a moment to look at this interesting question from the point of view of knowledge. As stated, all human beings are souls in evolution, and the soul knows what it needs. And, you know, it was said of Socrates that he was the wisest of all the Greeks because he knew that he didn't know. And sometimes that's how knowledge, our inner knowledge, our soul knowledge comes through us, to us. We are involved in our everyday world, and we begin to get intimations or intuitions that, is this all there is? There's got to be more to myself and to my life and to the reason I'm here, to my purpose, than just waking up, eating breakfast, going to school or going to work every day and going to bed and, you know, at the end of a few years, you know, just dying and that's it. I mean, you know, suffering and enjoying. There's got to be more to the purpose of life. And that is sort of the intuition coming through to us that there is more. It's almost an awakening call. And fortunate is the individual, especially in their life, in the present life, if they begin to wake up and search. And they will begin to look. And very often, they don't know it themselves, but they're beginning to look and pick it up from where they left off before. And they might go to a particular teacher, or to their religion, to a book, and they go there and they begin to search, and something within them sighs, says, ah, that sounds familiar, that rings true. Or they'll say, well, no, that's not for me, I'm going to keep looking. In other words, they have their own inner knowledge and wisdom that when they reach what they need to know, which is the next step of their spiritual evolution, they recognize it and begin to work from that point of view. That doesn't mean they neglect and turn away from their physical duties, but now they found a way to fulfill that higher need, which Maslow speaks of, the higher spiritual needs of the human being.
In the back.
If you stop and really think about it, thank goodness I have this personal life and I have this materialistic world, because how else could I ever test and apply these ideas? It isn't all just a sort of mental, oh, I'm on a spiritual plane. It is to use what you're learning and see if it works. And if it does, then you learn more and appreciate it more. So we don't think it's a complaint that I have this personal life that I have to lead. We think it's the testing ground.
Okay, so when you talk about these great souls and how they've gone through, like, I don't know how many thousands of lifetimes where their soul was perfected and then it arrived at the great soul, and then they preserve it in that last life. After that, do you believe, like, that soul then ascends into some sort of ascension? And if so, then even if you are consumed in your daily life and all of this, if you know these, the study of these things, and you can keep that in mind in your life, that maybe if you perfect a little bit more each time, that at some point you don't have to do a life like this, and maybe 25 lives from now.
So the question, if we understand it correctly, is does a great soul reach a point where they do not any longer have to incarnate? They can, as you put it, ascend to another plane. Is that the gist of your question? So, once again, let's start with the basic idea that we're all souls in evolution, reaching a certain stage of perfection. And as we read the devotional books, which are put forward by these same sources, we understand that there's two great paths that can be followed, the path of liberation and renunciation. And so a soul may proceed to gain what knowledge they can, the highest degree of knowledge. We almost might say in a kind of spiritual selfishness, because their motivation is the final reward, whether we call it nirvana or escape from the need to incarnate. And then there are those souls, that great souls, that follow the path of renunciation. In other words, they want to gain the knowledge, but let go, sacrifice the personal or the individual need for that. Rather, they are doing it all for the benefit of others. So when they reach that point where they can choose whether they will incarnate or not incarnate, they've learned all the lessons, through the habit and the intention of their many lives of sacrifice, they choose to stay with humanity, and they become the saviors of humanity. So a Mahatma, or a great soul, is an actual living, embodied great soul in a human form, with a personality, from a family, with a work to do, which is both part of their personal nature, and then a higher work, which is part of their great soul nature. So they make that sacrifice to dwell among humanity where they can be of that benefit to humanity in general and to those individual souls who struggle to pursue that same path.
And just so that we know that we will always be supported by these great souls, no matter how far we go, they are always there for us as well.
We'd like 2 points of clarification. One was that the philosophy talks about Mahatmas and how that's the ultimate potential or the ultimate perfection of all souls. And it also talks about adepts. And could we have a discussion what the difference between an adept and a Mahatma is and what their work is? And then the second is, I think we've heard that it takes eons to become a Mahatma, but I think we've also heard that when a person makes a decision to follow along a certain path, then it's a certain number of lives and amount of work to do it. So can we get clarification on that?
So is there a difference between a Mahatma and an adept? Well, there can be adepts of greater and lesser degree of knowledge and perfection. An adept is a soul that is much further along the path of spiritual development than we are. And in a sense, they can be categorized by the number of their principles that they have in control. And these principles belong to their intellectual, their mental, their moral, their spiritual, their psychic, and their physical nature. So a Mahatma then, or a great soul, we give them that designation, would be the highest degree of adeptship possible on this physical plane of existence, with all the limitations we have of physical matter and the physical body. Obviously, the perceptions of a great soul outside of a physical form are not as limited. And so it is a great sacrifice and a restriction to function through a human form. So a Mahatma represents that highest stage of adeptship possible. And it is said that once one becomes an accepted chela or has determined to self-consciously pursue without deviation a certain path under the direct guidance of a teacher, a higher adept or chela, that there only are 7 lives remaining until they reach adeptship, assuming they stay on that path. And of course, once they reach adeptship, there are further stages. So it may take many, many lives until they reach that point, but once a certain point is reached, their self-conscious evolution is accelerated. They are in the advanced track. They're in the hothouse of human evolution. And they take on that path with all its effort and struggling, because they know that they can reach that state of perfection and development quicker and therefore be better able to help others sooner than if they did not take it. So it takes a tremendous sacrifice and effort and on their part.
And one thing that we found is interesting is that once a Achela puts forth his desire and is working with a teacher, that teacher is also responsible for any type of misdeeds that his chela has performed. So this relationship between the two is really high spiritual bond that they do. Yes.
Well, it appears that there is nothing new under the sun when we take a look at the founding of the United States of America, the changes in government all over the world, and that we ourselves have in our hands the secret doctrine, Isis and Baal, and various other literature, where we may do our own research. And once we do our own investigation sincerely, it must be so, because there's so much that we can see or come in contact with that can be traced very far back in the history of mankind. So the idea is proof is available if we wish to investigate.
And an important point was brought out with the idea of studying on our own, because we talk about self-induced and self-devised means, that's how man progresses. And we're not having anybody, like with Christianity, that we're not giving our lives over to somebody who's going to protect us in a way. We have to do it ourselves. And that's how we progress on this path to perfection, is by doing it ourselves, by doing the duty that comes to us, and by helping others. And it sounds like a very simple path, but it's very complicated and does take a lot of effort on our part to concentrate on what we are doing for others and not holding grudges, that kind of thing. So self-induced and self-devised means is how we have to progress.
Well, that great adept we know as, or call, Jesus the Christ is recorded as saying that, "Follow not me, but the path I show. Greater things that I have done, you will do. I go to my Father, and you go unto yours." So even if we look at that teacher who is one of a line of many teachers and saviors of the world, we say the same spiritual direction, that the real spiritual authority lies within the spiritual nature and perception and power of every human being. We all have that Christos, that Buddhi, that Krishna principle within us, and to the extent that we know it, have assimilated it, have acted on it, understand it, determines the greatness of our soul. It's not something that's bestowed on us by any outside force or diploma. It's something that we've made, we've accumulated ourselves through our own effort, as was said. Yes?
Yes, in regards to the great souls, say that you had a situation where some people close to you have passed. And I guess from being looking at it from a Christian viewpoint all these years, but is there ever, for any reason, and I know there's no outside God, an invocation of a great soul, of somebody that died young to, I mean, I guess I'm saying I've prayed for people in the past. Is there anything in the philosophy where you would invoke a great soul?
To do what?
To help them in the afterlife? Or I guess not.
Well, the soul, the soul in the afterlife does not need our help.
Right, that's right.
It's in touch. It's living in its highest spiritual possibility as a personality. It is surrounded in its own mind by everything it's desired in its highest nature to achieve. All those it's loved. It's not even aware in that state of consciousness any more than we are aware in an intense dream of what is going around us. It is not even aware of the insufficiencies, the difficulties. It's not even aware that we are suffering and praying for it. It is completely surrounded by its love for its fellow beings that it had contact. If anything, it is the dynamic power of its thought and feeling in that state which is a benefit to us on this plane. And so many people in dreams or in other circumstances of life testify to feeling some help and guidance coming to them from those planes, either in sleep or in things that just happen to occur in the course of their existence. This is a an unending subject that opens up all sorts of possibilities and questions. We're going to continue with this idea of the theosophy and the theosophical movement. We've looked at the work of the great souls. So next Sunday we're going to be looking at what are the theosophical objectives? What's the purpose? What's the work? What's the goal of the theosophical movement in general? And then this Wednesday, as a follow-up, we might say, in our class, we are going to look at historical traces of the lives of these great souls and the influence that they've had, at least the influence that those we know from history, because it said there are many who have worked behind the scenes and we do not know their names or to have a record of their lives. So our meeting is adjourned, and we welcome you to come again.